And we had a choice that do we pay out our largest customers, like the top 10 largest customers, or do we pay out the rest 1,000 small customers? These large guys can manage without the money. The small guys are going to die tomorrow. And it was very simple. Like, I didn't have to think 5 minutes. I just pay out the small guys. Right? And the business team was very unhappy because the large guys are the ones that make money.
There is one learning for all founders, which is they have a DNA and they stick to that their values. And they say if small businesses matter, the decision is very easy.
Most people think success compounds, but rejections were compounding because you were making them compound. You were learning something from it and you were potentially getting the next step coming out of it. Right?
You know, I heard Avi say this a few days back and it really resonated, which was that with any of these AI tools, it can actually show up as either your smartest friend who, like you said, blew me away, or your dumbest friend who doesn't.
On the same day.
Sometimes in the same conversation.
Welcome to Unstarted. What is unique about this show is this is about you. It is for founders, by founders. We have a very special episode today, a double header of Unstarted and Intelligent Indians with two colleagues. One is my colleague and one is our founder, Harshal Mathur of Razorpay, Vikram Vaidyanathan at Z47. Very excited about it. Lots of stories to unpack. So welcome, guys. Yeah. Look forward to doing this. Let's go all the way back. Family background, and then we'll fast forward and Vikram will jump in. He knows more of the story.
Yeah. Vikram knows the entire story. He's been with us from day one. So, yeah, I think the early story is fairly simple. I was born and raised in Jaipur, average middle class family. Went schooling in Jaipur, went to IIT Roorkee. And was always interested in coding. Was coding since, I don't know, 6th standard. But unfortunately, didn't make the JEE rank for CS, so got into mechanical. So I used to spend my weekends, evenings coding even through college. I had no interest in mechanical. And there I met Shashank. We started doing stuff on the side while going for lectures and mostly sleeping through lectures.
And Shashank had a better rank, he's computer science.
Yeah, he's in computer science.
Because a lot of times people ask us, you know, should I choose a co-founder? Choose one with a higher rank.
Yes. And he was a senior to me in college.
So Shashank was senior.
Yes.
And talk about STS, because it was just such a formative thing in your lives.
Yeah, so the way it started is both me and Shashank, we met each other, a bunch of people like me came together and we started chatting that, hey, we want to code like in our evenings and weekends. We don't want to do anything else, but we're not getting it. Even when Shashank was in CS, most of the lectures are very theoretical. So where do you really do coding? Right? And you don't learn coding by just reading lectures. So we got together, a bunch of us, and we started a college group called SDS Labs. Where we would build projects together. So we built a project where we would stream the cricket matches inside college. This was before Hotstar, before all of that. We would pick up the cricket matches from a dish TV and stream it inside college so people would watch it.
What part of that was legal?
It's inside college. Like, it's their TV rooms were legal, so you said TV rooms are legal. Like, you have one TV room, everyone watches.
I don't think they were thinking that much. About it.
And today he runs one of the most regulated businesses in the country.
I mean, you just build stuff because it's cool, and inside college, who cares, right? Like, just build it and deploy. So we were doing that.
I remember there were companies like Napster, like there were a bunch of these streaming pirated kind of things. Were you inspired by some of them?
Yeah, inspired by that. But I think it was just simple that, hey, when we have to watch a World Cup, like was coming up, and we said, hey, we have to go down to our TV room and watch World Cup. Like, how do we watch on our laptop? The internet speed wasn't good enough to stream anything online. So, but local speed is decent enough. So then we said, hey, we can just hook a dish TV to a computer, stream it in the campus, and everyone can watch it. And that's how that started. So we created this SDS Loops. The group survives today, it continues to bring in young.
The group survives today. I just met a founder who was from SDS Labs last week, and he was talking about how that's become the core entrepreneurial fabric of IIT Roorkee.
Yeah. Were you guys making money doing it? Were you charging?
No, nothing. Like, nobody, we didn't care about money, honestly. We just say it's a fun thing to do.
The new generation is not like that.
We cared about money after it, but during the college, it's like, it's a cool thing to do. You're building in weekends, let's just build it. Like, we build like a bunch of stuff. We build up software to download softwares easily and all of that. Yeah. And that's how we got to work together with a bunch of folks like Shashank, and a lot of us started working together. So when we were graduating from college, we said that, okay, now this is ending. Now what next? And Shashank was graduating and he got placed in Microsoft in US. And we spoke to each other and he was like, hey, we should keep chatting on the side. Maybe there's something you can do, something else. And
what is Shashank's background? Is it also middle class?
Yeah, both of coincidentally, both of our dads work in State Bank of India. Used to work in State Bank of India.
Interesting.
In completely different terms.
And that's a very relatable background. So, did you see yourself becoming an entrepreneur? Mm-hmm. And in that light, are entrepreneurs born or made in your view?
I don't think I've ever thought of entrepreneurship or doing my own business. I mean, I come from an average background, like where people, like my dad expected me to get a job, all of, like that's the mindset that, and the best thing would be get a job in a great tech company, but I was not in CS, so I thought that even that is going to be hard. But I think business was never on the cards.
But talk about the Schlumberger time. I know it's one of the highest paying jobs on campus, as was the same for Shashank. But you quit in what, 4 months?
6 months, yeah. So for mechanical, like the highest paying jobs at companies that come on day zero is Schlumberger. It was a first day company, sat in it, got placed in it, excited and like celebrated. Of course, my dad celebrated and everyone like congratulated and all of that. Went into the job on day one, I realized this is not what I really want to do. Like,
and in those days, wasn't it like $100,000 plus?
Yeah, and it was
like, a lot of money.
It is life changing amount of money.
Yeah,
and not just for me, but for the entire family.
Yeah,
right. So, and got into Abu Dhabi. Right, so it's offshore. There's great like pay packages. Great like, and essentially the company takes care of your life. There's no money you have to spend. They give you 5-star accommodation. They give you food. They give you travel. They give you everything.
Yeah.
But actual job, like I did it and nothing against it, but it was not for me. Like I am a guy who wants to sit and code. I don't want to step on the field, and being an oil field is its own kind of job and there are people who like it. And I was very clear, this is not for me. So I told you that Shashank spoke to me that, hey, we should try something on our own. But I thought like he's a guy going to US. Like he's saying it, once he lands in the US, I'm sure he's going to forget all about me. But he kept in touch. So we kept chatting. And the good thing about oil field jobs is you have a lot of free time. Like you're offshore for a week, then you're free for 2 weeks, and then you're offshore for a week. So I would have a lot of free time. Most of my friends would go out and party during that. I was not one who enjoyed that a lot. So I'd again speak to Shashank, build stuff on the side, code stuff. And that's when we ran into this problem. We were building some side project, similar to SGS Labs. We were building a social crowdfunding platform. And we wanted to accept payments. And we thought, like, payments, this should be the easiest part of it. It turned out to be the hardest part of building it. So we reached out to all the largest banks and the largest payment companies, and we saw like it was very, very painful to get like payments, get started with payments. We went to like, Facebook was very popular, so we went to Facebook groups like Bangalore Startups, Pune Startups, and asked like, how does everyone solve it? And realized every startup founder had the same challenge. We were not even doing startup, we were doing a side project, but everyone had the same challenge. And everyone said, just start by accepting cash. It's easier to accept cash in India than to accept digital payments. And that irked my tech side. Like that, like the point of technology has generally been democratization. Like for example, like internet just allows anyone to start something, and like social media gives everyone a voice, right? Like so, e-commerce gives anyone an ability to sell something without setting up an office and all that. So, like how could digital payments be less accessible than physical payments? It didn't make any sense.
So we
and in our standard techie mindset, you're like, how hard could this be? Like, why is nobody solving it?
So let's pause there, because the next question will go there. But just some takeaways, even with what you have said before or till now. A lot of people ask us, you know, I'm sure they come to you for advice. Nowadays, is it like my son wants to drop out of college because I want to be an entrepreneur. But one theme that I've seen, which I didn't realize when this show started, is a lot of the entrepreneurs were doing entrepreneurship in college. And you can do that. And you started doing it in sixth grade with your... So I think that is a very actionable takeaway. You can have side hustles. Most of them, by the way, nowadays, they do make money while doing it. So I think that's a great takeaway. Second, lived experience. The other pattern that we have seen is, especially with first-time founders, theoretically starting a business versus starting a business where it's a lived experience. Why does it matter?
I think in B2B, it matters a lot. Like how would an average college guy coming out of college would know anything about like why businesses need to accept payments? What do businesses look for when they want to accept payments? What are their challenges? Like, it is impossible. So the empathy that you need to build a company is just very hard to bake in. You can have on consumer problems, you can still have empathy, because most consumer stuff, you can think of yourself that, hey, if I wanted to, let's say I'm starting Ola, I want to book a cab. I can imagine myself in that situation.
Yeah.
But how do I imagine myself in a business owner situation if I've not done that myself?
No, very good. Nobody has connected it this well. Lived experience is important so that you can empathize. and probably stay resilient through the ups and downs also.
Sure. You know, I never connected the dots. One thing that stands about all Razorpay communication is that the SME entrepreneur is the hero of that communication.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what you've done over the last 10, 12 years. Do you think that initial phase of struggle as an SME entrepreneur is what gave you that insight?
Yeah, and I think it's still important, right? Like in decision making today, right? Like there are a lot of times I have to, like me and Shashank have to push on that, hey, we can't take this decision because it will hurt the SME. Because again, the SMEs, an average SME is generally not the highest revenue driver for the company, right? So a lot of times we have to plug in, like, hey, we can't do this. Like I remember in one of those Yes Bank moratoriums when Yes Bank was frozen and a lot of money got stuck for us as well. And we had a choice that do we pay out our largest customers, like the top 10 largest customers, or do we pay out the rest 1,000 small customers? And essentially I took that call that, hey, these large guys can manage without the money for a week, 2 weeks, whatever, like whatever it takes for Yes Bank to clear up. The small guys are going to die tomorrow if they don't make their money. So you have to, like, unless you have that empathy, it's very hard for you to understand. Everyone will say, yeah, just pay this guy, his 2 crores is stuck and this guy's 10 lakh is stuck, but this guy is going to die without his 10 lakh. He can manage.
And I'm going to play this question.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what the question is.
Being a BTEC student, like, हमें वैसा एनवायरनमेंट नहीं मिल पाता है कि हम बिजनेस की चीजें सीख सके फिर और भी लाइक प्रैक्टिकल नॉलेज बेसिकली हम सीखे तो वो मैं कैसे करूं
सो इट्स सच अ ब्यूटीफुल क्वेश्चन राइट बट इट्स एग्जैक्टली द पोजीशन यू आर इन सो यू आर सेइंग फ्री टाइम में करो
या एंड आई थिंक आई कैन टेल यू लाइक फॉर एग्जांपल द हार्डेस्ट पार्ट इन बिल्डिंग अ पेमेंट्स बिजनेस इज यू नीड टू गेट अ लॉट ऑफ बैंक अप्रूवल्स एंड सर्टिफिकेशंस एंड सो व्हाइल द प्रोवर्ड पार्ट ऑनेस्टली वाज इजीएस्ट बिकॉज वी इमेजिन दैट हे लाइक If I was starting, I'm building an online payment platform and I need payments, how should it look like? And we built it from that. But the bank part was hardest. So what I did was, like, I had a holiday. I went to a bank branch next to my home and just ran into it and said, hey, I want to start a payment gateway. How do I go about it? And the guy looked at me and laughed. Like nobody comes to a bank branch in Jaipur and says, I want to start a payment gateway. He said, do you want a payment gateway? I said, no, I want to start my own. How do I get your APIs? And the guy had no idea. So he said, yeah, I can connect you to somebody in the Delhi office. And I said, sure. He connected me to somebody. I spoke to them. They understood what I wanted to do. And then they rejected us. So then I went to the next bank, did the same thing. And at the next bank, Shashank did the same thing on his side. We started figuring out people on LinkedIn, somebody who heads payment gateway business at this bank and that bank. Most of those folks are based in Mumbai. So we got connected with those people, sent a lot of requests. Some of them just rejected us. But the rejections were good because every time we spoke to some of these guys, they gave us something more. They told us something more. Like, and we pushed them, like, why are you rejecting? What is missing? And they said, you don't understand the business that well. You don't understand this part of the business very well. You're not understanding the risk of this and all of that.
And would they make another introduction for you?
We'll push them. That, hey, is there somebody? And he said, hey, maybe you can reach out to the senior in my bank and maybe he can help. And that's how we kept pushing. So I think there's no simple answer to that. Just keep pushing, my opinion.
No, but I think there's a big actionable takeaway, right? So you are saying it's not just hustle. Rejections were compounding for you because you were learned. Most people think success compounds, but rejections were compounding because you were making them compound. You were learning something from it and you were potentially getting the next step coming out of it. Right?
Yeah, and so that's how we kept moving. I would have met, like, almost in that 3-6 months period, I would have met, and we mostly being rejected, but almost 100-ish bankers in some.
Yeah. So in my own erstwhile Bazi days, I had to build a payment gateway because everything would fail. Vikram had done a thesis on payment gateways where there was no opportunity. Well, there was an opportunity, but there were 10 payment gateways out there. So how did you think you would, the payment gateways were there.
Yeah. Fortunately or unfortunately, I think I had no idea which payment gateways are there.
Ignorance is actually.
Yeah, but what I did know is I was in these communities of Bangalore startups, Pune startups, and nobody in these communities was happy with what was available.
Yes.
So that was my easiest signal that maybe there were 100 payment gateways, but the ecosystem was not happy with what was available. The ecosystem was looking for something else. And that was my signal that, like, I didn't care who else existed. The ecosystem that really matters was not being serviced by them. So, and what we discovered later was that, yes, there were a lot of payment gateways. Everybody was solving for large companies.
Yes.
Because the volumes were at the large companies. So everybody was solving for Airtels of the world, but nobody was solving the startups of the world. And this is 2014, 15 startups are coming up, but they were not a very exciting or a sexy ecosystem. That
was Stripe already there? No.
Stripe was there globally, not in India.
But were you in any way inspired by them or did you know about
We looked up at Stripe and honestly, one of the questions was that why is something like this not in India? Like, and the choice was, let's wait for something like that to come to India or we build it our own.
So people ask us a lot, just finishing this thought, people ask us a lot about ICP, and it in your case and what people should know, it's not whether the product it exists or not. It's about whether for your ICP does the product exist. Yeah. And you were very clear from day one. And you can always be inspired by what's working globally.
Yeah. So talk about this insiders versus outsiders. And I remember you were the first team which was a non-financial services team to start a payment gateway. And so you didn't have the network, but you also didn't have this baggage of I have to build for the large and so on. So how does being an outsider in such a, you know, slightly insider-driven landscape help?
Honestly, it actually worked well for us. And I'll give you some examples, right? Like most payment gateways at that point of time in India looked very similar. Because what most payment gateways did was they went to the bank, took their API, built their wrapper on top of it, and then sold to customers. And because bank APIs were same, the payment gateways looked the same. We didn't get access to banks on day one, right? So we were building a payment gateway without having knowing what the bank said. So we assume the bank said is a black box. It looks in some shape. We have no idea how it will look. But we'll build from merchant perspective that how would a merchant want to use it? And so when we built our product from that perspective, we got bank APIs maybe 6 months after we built the product. And then we plugged the bank APIs. So we had to do a lot of work to build a scaffolding because the bank APIs looked completely different than what we had put out to our merchants. But it worked well because we were building merchant first and not bank first, and which is the right way to build it. Like, why should you build it based on your supplier? You should build it based on your customer. So I think being an outsider helped shape the product direction in the right way because we didn't have access to those. And I think a lot of stuff, decisions that we took, we were able to take it because we had no idea how the industry works. We had a great idea of how startups work. So we were chatting with these guys, we were in co-working spaces, there were a lot of startups around us. We would sit with them, set up the payment gateway for them, ask them like, what do they like, what do they dislike, and we'll keep modifying it. And I think the most important part is you have to be in the ecosystem that you're going to serve rather than the ecosystem that's going to help you serve. And I think it worked well for us. Of course, it had its own challenges. The bank approval process alone took us so long. So we started building this properly, like full time. We left our jobs in 2014. It took us a year to take it live. 2015 is when we went live. Most tech spaces don't take this long because you're dependent on approvals and all of that. So that was the hard part of being an outsider. Yeah.
One of the things I remember, so when you are starting something where incumbents already exist, even though you may be catering to a new ICP, I do think it's very important to say, how am I still going to be better? Because that incumbent can easily come into your space, right? And I remember you guys had very clear metrics at the starting point of how you would be better. Yeah. Was it failure rates? Yeah.
Yeah, success rate was the most important. And again, from merchant perspective, like what do...
65% success rate.
Yeah,
65. And your goal was 85-90%.
And
today that is?
90% plus, 92-93, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was very clear, right? And even today, that's the primary metric for the company. Like that success rate has to be higher than anyone else. And what can we do more to increase? Like at that point, we moved by 2-3 percentage points. Today, now we move by 0.1, 0.2 percentage points. It's still the same effort and rigor that goes in.
Yeah.
And I think it was simple. Like we were speaking to merchants, and the merchants, what they care about. Like payment gateway, I tell my team, you are like a utility company. Like nobody cares when your electricity is coming. Nobody says, hey, what electricity is coming. But the 5 minutes that you're down, like you're going to get all the abuses in the world, right?
Yeah.
So your job is to avoid the 5 minutes that you can ever go down.
Right?
And that like that mindset is something that we still drill down in our company. Like unlike a consumer company, we don't optimize for time on our platform. We have to actually minimize the time on our platform.
Yeah.
We have to actually minimize the time it takes. Like the quicker we are, the less time people spend on our platform, the better it is for us. And those things are like, we have to change. A lot of people come from consumer backgrounds. We have to change this DNA that, hey, don't increase the time on our checkout. You can't add animations on our checkout, which take away consumers' time. You're doing disservice. So we have to do a lot of that mindset change. And it's still the primary metric is how do we improve success rate?
Talk about YC, Y Combinator. I think you were one of the first ones to go there, probably one of their poster child investments. And I want to hear from Vikram, how we did a very heavily diligenced investment in Razorpay.
Yeah, I think YC happened completely like unexpectedly, honestly, because we were building this. We had not yet got the bank approval. This is 2014, mid and late. We were building the product. We were speaking to customers, but we had to waiting for the bank approval. And the YC application form came up. We were, of course, always reading Hacker News. So we went and applied with literally zero expectations because we had, like, not a lot of Indian companies have gone into YC. We thought like we are building such an Indian focused thing, and we filled the form. But I think we did a lot of diligence in filling the form right. Like because I think the good part about the YC form is that it asks you the question that most founders should ask themselves when they're starting a company. but they typically don't, right? So we went, we actually spent our time that it asks you, like, why would somebody use you or like something else, and what are you doing differently and all of that. Spent a lot of time figuring that out, applied to YC, got called for an interview in US. And so we thought we might not make it back to US again, because I don't know if we can afford a ticket. So we said, let's pack this schedule with meetings. Let's use the best of this week, because YC interview is a 10-minute interview. How do we use the entire schedule? So we did like 7 meetings a day for this 5 days that we were there. And then we did the YC interview, and it is a 10-minute interview, so it went in a jiffy. And then in the evening, we got a call that we got into YC. So it was like, honestly, it was completely unexpected. But the YC did impact the course of the company significantly, because, and like, we had a choice that we want to move completely to US for these 3 months. We want to stay, one guy stay here, one guy stay there. We said we want to make the best of YC. So we both of us moved there for 3 months. And it was the best exposure we could have to, like, global standards of building, global standards of product, what teams are doing, and how teams are solving their problems, meeting some of the best folks that we could meet in terms of mentors. I think it was like completely an amazing experience. And honestly, it said a lot of, I don't think it was anything specific. It's not like YC told us, hey, build a product this way. In fact, they don't even go into execution details. Yeah. But just the exposure alone, it's like IITs, like just the exposure alone to people there was enough to change the course of the company.
So before I give my side of the story, I'd love to hear your side, because I know you also tried pitching to VCs in the beginning, and then you said, forget this.
Yeah, we pitched, we started pitching, we were in Jaipur, we started pitching pre-YC to some VCs and stuff, and everybody just said the same thing. There's so many payment gateways, it's a utility product, like, why are you guys getting into this? And we just walked out. So we did few of those meetings, we realized it's not going to happen, we went into YC. And while we were going through YC, suddenly we got a ping from somebody on LinkedIn, and he said, hey, I heard you guys are building something in payments. This was Rajat.
Yeah.
I heard you guys are building something in payments, and you guys got into YC. And he said, I've not told anyone we got into YC. Mm-hmm. We were keeping it very quiet, like,
hustler
max. Nobody knew you were in YC.
And they didn't want to respond, because they said, you know, VCs don't get it, so we don't want to respond.
Yeah, we said we don't want to do anything till the YC demo day, because it's going to be painful. So, yeah. But we said, like, but then we saw, like, hey, Matrix Partners and all of that. And I mean, we had read about Matrix Partners. We saw, like, it's a massive VC firm. It seems like we can't miss it. So we set up a meeting just with zero hopes. Yeah.
So the other side of the story is that I had a payment thesis, and at that point of time mobile was just beginning to take off, and our forward view was commerce is going to be on mobile, and these payment gateways don't work very well on mobile, and so we were a little bit hammer looking for a nail, because we were like, this is our thesis. And we had invested in another IIT Roorkee founder, Rajinder had invested in another IIT Roorkee founder, and that's how we knew that you got into YC, because that founder told us.
Oh.
And so therefore Rajinder told Rajat, and then Rajat knew that I had this thesis that I really wanted to invest in. And honestly, it was one of those where it is prepared mind meets opportunity. And I think it was the same for them.
But I can tell you, the first meeting, at least from our perspective, didn't go very well. Because we were not prepared at all. Like, so we said something, I don't know what it landed to you, but I felt like we did a very unimpressive job. I thought this guy's never going to invest in us.
Yeah.
But for us, it was essentially just this. They said mobile, they said failure rates, and I had just spoken to others who had invested in payments, and they said the only thing that mattered in PayPal was frictionless merchant onboarding. And somehow, you know, everything that I had learned was exactly what you guys were saying. And so for us, it was a fantastic meeting.
We broke all the rules. And I remember meeting you on Skype in those days. And having built it in Bazi myself, I'm like, but here's the problem. And I think it's a very instructive thing. You guys had gone so deep in the banking architecture, you had an answer for everything. You had thought about it. So,
and I remember the internal conversation where we had not invested without meeting founders at that point in time. This was on Skype. We were not even in the same geography.
Yeah.
And we said we are going to, and it was also YC had this process where you had to sign the term sheet, wire the money, and then we were going to meet. So it was one of those where for us, it was breaking a lot of internal rules, but it also seemed like the easiest decision that we were making just in terms of the process.
So the best $1 million we have ever invested, And so whenever, you know, you start your next one, please consider only us. But anyway, so taking it forward from there, you guys get started. I know that there are multiple inflection points. Talk about the journey. From the outside, it looks like a raging success. What happened between at the various, what are the big milestones in the company's history? We'll come to the next question as part of that, because I know one of which was COVID, but before that was Demon. Just talk us through, and what were the big heart attacks along the way?
Yeah, and the first 2-3 years was extremely hard, extremely hard. Not from a perspective, like, we were still very motivated, but like a B2B business in payments, it has its own inflection curve. Like, you can't fast track it, unlike consumer and similar spaces. There's no way to even pour money at the problem. We had raised a significantly large amount of money because of post YC in 2015. There was a lot of excitement about India. So we got funded from you guys, you got funded from Tiger. We raised a large round for the size of company we were. And then there was so much pressure that, hey, we have raised like $11 million. You're like, you need to scale really rapidly.
Yeah.
But unfortunate part of a fortunate part of a B2B business is, like, there's no way to use that money to grow faster. It's not like you can't discount your way through it. You can't cash back your way through it. Like when business folks buy like payments, they don't buy it because you're offering, like, price is a factor, but it's not a primary factor. And it's still very less understood. Like the B2B side is very comparatively much lesser price sensitive than consumer side, because the guy cares about utility and value so much more. If I deliver a poor success rate by 1 percentage point,
yeah,
it doesn't matter what price I'm giving.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter at all. The price is not even a discussion in those meetings. So we had to prove our product. We had to prove that we can serve large customers. And honestly, for the first 2-3 years, we had zero large customers. We were only very, very small startups who were using us, not even a mid-sized customers. I remember a conversation I had with Vikram where we were trying to attack some of the large guys and we were not getting any headroom. And Vikram said, like, you can, there's a hunting example he gave, that you can hunt elephants, you can hunt deers, or you can hunt rabbits. And you can think that you'll hunt one elephant and you'll be chill for your life. It's never going to happen. So generally you have to hunt rabbits and then maybe try to get one deer. Don't try to go for elephants early. And that landed very well for us because we're trying to do everything.
Yeah.
We're trying to support startups. We're trying to do mid companies. We're trying to do elephants. And there is this like greed of sort that if we get this one large guy, our life will be sorted.
Yeah.
Like, I have to take so much effort to onboard these 1,000 small guys. And we realized that there's no way to fast track it. So like the first large customer that went live with Razorpay was GoIBibo.
Yeah.
And it went live in, I think, 2017, 2 years after we had started. For one reason, because their core payment partner failed for a week and they wanted to try something else. So that was our first win, and we said, like, we need to do this really well. So we had like an entire team dedicated to ensuring that merchant sees the best of Razorpay. We built a lot of features just for them. And by the way, it didn't go so well. Like, they went live with us, they used us, and then after a couple of months, they paused us completely because we were not meeting their standards. We put all our energy to ensure, because that was going to be our benchmark merchant. That's going to tell every other merchant that, hey, Razorpay can serve enterprises now. It took a lot of efforts, almost 6-8 months to stabilize that. And that became our gateway to tell it. Now I went to every other merchant and say, yes, go IBO users, like, call them. And B2B takes a lot of time.
So let's dig deeper into that. So one good advice from Vikram, so it affected how your GTM and it was a harder compounding moat that you were building. These crucible moments, like, you know, getting Go by Bibo right, again, many other payment companies would have been doing and trying to get payment gateway. I mean, you were replacing somebody.
Yes.
So that company that you were replacing was also trying to do a of great course. Job. What did you do differently?
I think it was just hustle. Like, we and essentially just sat down and said, like, no matter what happens, you have to give them the best experience they can have. And not just experience in terms of product, servicing, sales, support,
so
everything.
You can as a startup probably go deeper with a customer than a large incumbent.
Yeah, so the large incumbent had hundreds of customers.
Yeah.
GoIBibo was one of them.
Yeah.
Right. And they were getting attention. It's not like they were not, but not the attention that we could give.
Yeah.
And honestly, none of that mattered if our product couldn't deliver. And we realized, like, even spite of all the efforts and all the support, we got paused after a month or two because you're not meeting the standard. So, like, product is first, everything else is scaffolding on top, and you can use that scaffolding to fight a lot of things. You can't fight a bad product. So having the product right and then having all of that, like, that allowed us to really compete and ensure that they get stabilized and they continue to give us majority of the volumes. Once we had that, then it became like it was actually our proving point. It was our foot in the door to larger customers.
If I can, those 2 years, 2015 to 17, and you know, you and I used to keep doing these calls, and I used to find that even though we didn't have the output metrics of, you know, closing this big customer and so on, but the inputs were just inflecting, right? Whether it was failure rates, whether it was merchant onboarding experience, number of banks. So I know it was a period of struggle, but at least from the outside, for me, you were building both foundation and reputation, yeah. Especially in this landscape that reputation was very important.
Yeah, I know. And I remember, like, I mean, that we were building and we had a lot of money in the bank, right? So, but we had no way to forcefully spend it because our spend was hiring and you can't just hire. Like, we were very, very selective in our quality of hire. And I think that was one of the good decisions in that, because there were a lot of pressure at times that, hey, if we hire like 20
you guys built a very strong team very early, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of pressure. Yeah. And if I hire 50 more people, and I'll actually put it on Shashank, because at one point I even told Shashank, why don't we just reduce our standards, get these 50 people, get the things we want to get out of the door, and maybe you can raise our standards again. And that doesn't work, right? Like, once you reduce your standards, once you have a B team, you have a B team. Like, you can't change.
I have to pause you there. Once you have a B team, you have a B team. You are building foundation and reputation even when the metrics may not be showing up. So I think that relentless grind in that period is probably on the right thing is very important.
Yeah, and that's the hardest part. Like, everyone talks about the funding.
Yeah.
You have a funding, you celebrate it, everyone claps and you go home. And then you have to go and build. And the next, like, and I mean, startup founders, like, a lot of startup founders are not prepared for the 2-3 years of grind that every company has to do. No matter how much traction you have, no matter how everyone is celebrating you and all of that, the 2-3 years of grind to just get something off the ground, is you can't just match it.
And you know what I've observed, that, and you see it a lot in the Valley, but now you're starting to see it in India, you actually have situations where companies are taking off like this. But unka 2-3 years of grind baad mein aata.
Baad mein aata.
Hamesha aata hai. There is no getting away.
Wo grind is like, you can't fight it. Like, you'll skyrocket it and then it'll plateau and then you'll have to do the grind. It starts, like, maybe that's how it's changing in the AI world. But the grind is there.
I have one founder who I keep telling that enjoy, because you have taken off like this. And he's in year 5 now or 4. He's like, Avnish, abhi bhi aayega kya? I said, aayega. Sorry to tell you, but aayega. Let's take the next question, because I think it is very core, and then we will go to the COVID story, because I think you started very clearly with a ICP, with a mission. And I think this question goes to that, which is deciding on what/who. What you work on is often more important than how you work. So for someone still not decided where they should start up, how should they decide what to work on or whom they should work with? And zooming out a little bit, the mission, who you are serving, and what happened during COVID. And maybe, Vikram, you have a better ringside view. I remember all of us were doing various forms of whatever we could do in that period, including putting out content. And I remember there was some crucible moment for Razorpay and you sending, replying to tweets yourself. So what happened? And we have to go back to how did that connect back to the mission?
Yeah. No, I think, first of all, on COVID piece, right? Like COVID hit everyone suddenly, right? And I don't think anyone was prepared.
Or maybe it was a Yes Bank. I don't remember which one.
No, it's been multiple ones. But okay. I would say
both.
So, and I was going to pick up this thread on crisis and opportunity. Yeah. But every crisis, and actually now it's not even crisis, I see you on Twitter, I see you on different WhatsApp groups, that if some merchant, some customer has a problem, you're there.
Yeah. He leads from the front.
And during the crisis, you were like the traffic cop, managing customers, internal team, everything. Where does that ethos come from?
Yeah, I think there's no fighting. And this came from day one, right? Like, from day one, I would speak to our customers. As I said, like, when we were building Razorpay, we were working with banks, we were trying to do all of that. But the one thing that kept us going when we were facing all these rejections, right, is that I was constantly speaking to our customers. I was constantly speaking to our potential customers at the point of time on how they do. And that was my real source of energy. We'd go to a bank, get rejected, and then I'd go and speak to the customer and they'd say, please solve this for me. If you solve this for me, you're going to solve something for my life. And I get that energy to go to the next bank and pitch the same thing. And I think that continued as company built on. So today also, I speak to at least one customer a week. The advantage of that is, A, it gives me a real view of what we are doing well, what we are not doing well. But also, it's my real source of energy. Like, are we making a difference in their life? Do they care if we go away for a day? And And I think that really is hard to match. So
this is, you are our customer. This is our real source of energy. But it's a very, very important takeaway, because this has been a theme, but I didn't think of it the way it started with you. It is because if you start with lived experience and you use the word empathy, that empathy basically carries throughout. And I still remember somebody posting during COVID, my payments are failing, this, that, and it wasn't, they didn't even tag you.
Yeah.
And you were responding yourself with your number.
I am in a lot of startup groups, and every startup group, like people were like, hey, I have this issue or this issue, and I'm the first one to DM them, even on Twitter. Like, and the idea is like, I mean, A, it helps me get a very real view of what we did wrong. Right? Like, I can always pass it to somebody and take a screenshot and send to somebody, hey, reach out to this guy. But then I won't get a real view of what did we actually do wrong. Where did our system fail? Because of which this guy had to post on a group, right? Like, people are, and I think in the B2B world, people are generally fairly empathetic and also fairly logical, right? Like, if they're posting in a group, means they have exhausted their standard options. And I need to figure out why did the standard ways didn't work. And that's how we really improve.
I don't think any of that is true. I think most B2B companies have zero empathy, very bad customer support, and that's why you are where you are.
I think I have generally seen that, like, the we work with founders, we work with like people who are building businesses. I've generally seen they understand. In fact, we have messed up.
I mean, all the good ones have to, right?
And we have messed up. We have messed up a lot of times. Like, in the early days, I think Vikram knows this story. We did our YC launch. Went live, and I think about a month after our YC launch demo day, where we were covered in TechCrunch and other, the bank that we were partnered with pulled the plug, and our entire system was down for a week. 20-30 merchants would go on live, who trusted us, young startup, to power their payments, and their payments couldn't go through because Razorpay is now down. Now what do we do? And one rule I set for the team, we were like a team of 7-8 people, I said, we'll pick up every phone, we'll talk to every customer, we'll tell them, even if they abuse us, we're going to constantly talk to them. Like, because it's easy for people to say, this guy is going to just troll me and abuse me, and let me switch off my phone, let me turn off the interfaces. We spoke to every single customer. Some of them were empathetic, some of them were abusive, and I mean, proper Hindi aggressive abuses that he heard. But I can tell you that the guy who abused is still live as a merchant on Razorpay today. Right? So
amazing. I heard this from a founder yesterday, that their most abusive customer, they told the team that I want you to treat them the nicest, because they will be the ones that will teach us the most. Amazing, amazing learning. Guys have seen many crises together.
So
what other
talk,
things
talk about? There's so many crises, right? So Yes Bank happened, Demon happened. There's so many of these that came along the way. But almost every crisis I've seen you turn into an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that is something that you consciously thought about, or it just sort of happened.
Yeah, I think it's sort of happened, honestly. When you're going through a crisis, I don't think it's not, and in that mindset, it's really hard to think of. So I remember the Yes Bank situation, right? Like, it was an evening, I think in March in 2020. And it was at 7-8 p.m. We were all heading home. I just left the office, and then this notification came that Yes Bank is going to be frozen, right? And I was on the way to office. I said, like, and we had a lot of dependence on Yes Bank. So I just went back to office.
At that time, how much of our business was Yes Bank?
So a lot of our core payment gateway business, fortunately, was not on Yes Bank, but our Razorpay X payouts, all of that was on Yes Bank.
Yeah.
It was 100-ish plus crores of our customers' money was stuck in Yes Bank.
Oh, wow.
And so I just went back to office. I realized this is going to be a night. We pinged our leadership group. Everyone came back to office slowly. Everyone started coming back to office. And we sat in the room and we started figuring, like, what all its impacts, who all is impacted, what is our game plan. And we just started, and everyone just started rolling in. I think within an hour, I think around 40-50 people, the entire leadership team was there. I think by midnight, like, there were like 200-300 people in the office. Everyone was just working and figuring out on its own. And it's not just like the people who are directly responsible, like our housekeeping staff came back, our admin staff came back. They were arranging food for these people, they were arranging coffee, because and all of this is happening organically. Like, these are the times when you really see the company culture come alive. And I remember, like, after a point, I was just sitting on the side and I had nothing to do. Because once I said these are the five things we need to focus on, and everyone just took charge. The team just took charge. And I was just sitting, waiting, if there's a decision pending on me, that should come to me. But execution was completely on them. There's nothing for me to do in terms of execution.
Amazing.
I think the company culture is just, like, built.
But that wasn't built overnight. That's all the grind, the 2-3 years.
All the grind, that's like the culture that you've set over the years.
B team is always a B. All of this is now showing up in this.
Showing up. And we were very, very transparent. We called every customer. We called every guy. We put on email that this is what we are doing to do. And this is when we took the call that, hey, like I remember like our finance team presented that this is how much money is stuck. These are the guys I can pay out. And we pumped into our own cash to say, hey, can we pay out some of these guys? And these are guys I can pay out right now. So the choice was like pay out these 10 large guys or pay out these 1,000 small guys. And it was very simple. Like I didn't have to think 5 minutes, like just pay out the small guys. Right? And the business team was very unhappy because the large guys are the ones that make money. Right? So hey, this guy's going to be pissed. We're not going to get his business again and all of that. I said, like, it honestly doesn't matter. We got legal notice from those large guys that how can you not pay us out? Because we know you've paid out these small guys. How can you not pay us out? And he said, we'll handle this.
By the way, we got pings at that period from some of your customers saying they are paying those, they are not paying us.
Yeah.
We're like, we don't get in the middle.
I will say in these crises, there is one learning for all founders, which is they have a DNA and they stick to that their values. And they say, if as small businesses matter, the decision is very easy. If product tech and failure rates matter, the decision is very easy. And I think that's lasted you through every crisis.
Yeah, and it's fairly simple. Like your principles that you've said, like if you're going to like go away from it during crisis, then what's the point of those principles, right?
So very good.
And I think and you have to stay by it. And I think, I mean, we can, and I spoke about company culture and all of that is something we spend a lot of time on. But some of these decisions come to founders, honestly. It's very hard for, like, in respect to the company culture and everything, it's very hard for anyone else to take the decision because it's a very hard call. Like, you are essentially taking a call to hurt your business for your principles.
Yeah.
It's going to be very hard for anyone who's not in that position to take that call. So, like, being there in that room, my only job was to take such calls.
Yeah. No, and you know, there's that famous cliche, but it is not, because it's showing here, which is that culture eats strategy, right? So longer term, that's the only job of a founder. I mean, if you can get the culture right, the strategy will flow. Which, I mean, if you look at some of these, what Jeff Bezos did with Amazon, what Steve Jobs did with Apple, they set the culture. And of course, some of them also were very hands-on, which is also correct. But
no, but I think it's true. I think everyone in that leadership team was watching what decisions we were taking.
Yeah.
And it set the tone for like next few years. Like,
yeah.
Everyone saw that in that moment, the decisions we took. So it was not just about the customers. It was also for our team.
Yeah.
If we diluted from that positioning, it will set the tone for everyone else as well. That, hey, at the end of the day, culture and all is fine. Like startups and all of we talk about is fine. At the end of the day, it's revenue that matters.
Yeah.
Like, you would set that tone. And then that is your culture.
Yes,
it's,
absolutely.
It's not what you put up on the wall. It's not a saying that, hey, SMEs matter.
Yeah.
It's what you do because the team is going to carry it now for every day.
So one thing I've seen in through all of these big decision points is they actually make it very simple by saying, hey, does this actually meet our principles or not? And therefore, the decision is simple.
Yeah.
And therefore, that translates to the entire org because everyone in the org sort of thinks and acts the same way.
Yeah. And then comes AI. So the world has changed in the last, I guess it keeps changing, but starting November 22, but maybe even more after December 25. And I know you've been leading the charge, Vikram. I'll let you lead some of this, but let's take the question first.
As a founder building in AI, how do you think AI changes industries?
So it's a very global macro question, but AI does change all industries. One macro answer to that is go industry by industry, but let's talk about all the stuff that you guys have been doing.
So before we, you know, maybe just zoom out from this question, I've seen you take every new tech wave, you've sort of dived in head on. And maybe as an early startup, it's easy to do because it's, you just want to take
next
wave.
Job, yeah.
But when you become a large org, there is a risk of going after every new tech wave, but you've gone after it. So how do you sort of think
and
about
how do you differentiate in that regard shiny object versus real tech?
Yeah, and honestly, that's the harder part, right? Like, see, I think we are a pro tech company. The only thing that differentiates us from the other players in the same industry is how good our product and tech is. It's at the end of the day, that's that simple. We can't say, hey, our logistics is better, our operations is better, or something else. Like, it's only product and tech at the end of the day. The hard part of product and tech is it's ever changing. It's always changing. We spoke about like we build the fastest onboarding and everyone else will catch up with it. We build the fastest integration, everyone else will catch up with it. Because in the tech world, it's not very hard to replicate, look at what is successful and replicate it, right? The only thing that keeps us going is how do we ensure that we are first to the next thing that happens. And it's consistently a hard part, right? So, and it gets harder and harder at scale. So like this FTX, this FTX, we launched 100 plus launches, right? And most companies will launch one or two things. We did 100 launches. The reason we had to do is because we have to be first at everything. And that's the culture and the company. Right? We have to be first in everything new that happens in this ecosystem. We have to be the first at it. And a lot of times we'll do things which will not take off, and it's fine. And that is, you fail fast, you close it, you move on to the next thing. But you do try and be first at everything. So if even if there's one new launch that happens in the ecosystem that somebody else does and that we have not done, my first ping to the team is, why did we not do it first?
So failure is not penalized, being first is not acceptable.
Yeah, you can't not be first. So if somebody launches something, I see it on social media and I post it to my team, how did we miss it out? How were we not first at it? And I think, and we do a deep RC, why did we not pick it up? Like, who took that call? And it's simple.
Do the only time I can see the potentially tyrant side of Archel is like, how are we not first? Everything else was very, we love our customers, we build a culture, like, how are we not first? But that's also the culture.
Yeah, that's also part of culture. So, yeah. And I think so every single new thing that happens in the payment industry, we have generally been the first one. So 2016, remember UPI came in, like everyone was saying, hey, will UPI take off, not take off? SBI and HDFC were not on UPI. So everyone said, without two large banks, who's going to do UPI? We were the first payment gateway to launch UPI. We were very small. We had like 10,000 businesses, but we went live, and it was. And what happened is that, like, when UPI did take off, in 2-3 months, suddenly UPI started taking off. We were the only payment gateway serving UPI. So a lot of large customers came to us just because they wanted UPI. The largest guys were not, and everyone was 6 months away. We were ready, and we got that in. So we rode that wave. And similarly, it happened. And while these are the positive guys, we built a bunch of stuff that never took off. We built an invoicing system that never took off. We built a lot of stuff, small start products.
That, I guess, that comes with the territory then of innovation.
Yeah, because if you're taking that call, you want to be first at everything. You can't ensure that everything is going to be successful. So you take that hard choice, but it worked.
Did you get sucked into the crypto blockchain wave?
We looked at a blockchain wave very closely. We looked at crypto very closely. One part was the regulation part was very clear that, hey, you can't, the regulatory part side was very clear that you can't touch it.
And by this time, you had learned to follow the law.
Yeah. Yeah. I think building in the fintech space and building in the like one of the most regulated spaces, from day one, it was very clear to us that, like, you can fight everything, but if you mess up on regulation, it's going to be very hard to fight it out.
So, and you guys are actually the opposite. You're very, very...
So let's go back to the AI question. And I know maybe after like 7-8 years, I've seen you become so energized with tech where you are, you know, what I hear from everyone around you is that you have locked yourself in a room and you're building.
Yes.
And I know you formed this 2-member hacker team, which is sort of just building. So talk about that. How you embraced it?
Yeah, no, so I think everybody has been using AI and ChatGPT, but like in November, December, the newer models started rolling in. And I think I tried first time in late December or early Jan, newer models from the model companies. And something changed, right? I think it became from AI being an assistant to became AI an execution engine, or AI is a...
Agentic world took over, right?
Yeah. The model was smart enough that it didn't need guidance. It didn't need for you to tell him that do this and do that. The tool calling became so amazing. And I remember, like, I tried OpenClaw for the first time around end of Jan. And I set it up and I'm like, wow, like, this is just going to change the world. Because, and not the product itself, but just this capability now that the model has, that you can really trust the model with hardcore execution end to end. You create a plan with it. You tell it what it needs to do. I think that intelligence on the fly, like, and execution intelligence on the fly is just like, was just mind blowing. I think so. For the first time, I started picking up and building products myself. Like, I think after 6 years maybe, and started building stuff with it. Started tinkering with it. Started using it to set up a agent to do like meeting review notes for me. Started using it to do a diet plan for me and being a dietitian for me, and all that. I just started doing a bunch of stuff. I think after I set up OpenClaw, I think for 3 to 4, 5 days, I think people in the office said, like, I don't know where you are, but you are completely distracted, because I couldn't focus on work at all. I was like just logged into this, testing its limits, testing what it can do, testing what I can do with it. And it just like blew my mind. And I think after that, I moved to Cloud Code and all of that. And I think, but I think what fundamentally became clear to me is that this changes everything. And there's no point of saying that the world is going to be the same. So after a couple of weeks from there, like, we sat down in a room and like Shashank said, like, if this is where it's gonna head, like, we don't want to wait to get disrupted by something like this. Like, so if I were to start RazorPay today, how would I build it? Knowing that this technology exists. And I said, how is our onboarding gonna look like? How would our support look like? How would our integration look like? How will our dashboard look like? How everything that customer interacts with look like? And we realized that is going to be completely different. Everything is has to completely change. And I said, let's do that. So we worked for the next 2-3 months. We just said, like, let's completely rebuild everything. And this FTX, we launched it, which was everything from onboarding to integration to support to dashboard. We completely, and it is not easy because there's a lot of love for what we have built as well. Like, you're proud.
Why can't I go to a chat, Razorpay chatbot, and say, set up my business online?
Yeah, and that's what you do now.
That's what it is now.
That is onboarding.
But I think just for the audience to know, ChatGPT brought AI to the masses. OpenClaw is probably a bigger disruption when it comes to workflow for the masses. Yeah. Anybody can build it, their workflow.
Yeah, and OpenClaw is like the WWW movement, right? Yeah. Like, it's not about the internet itself.
Yeah.
It's the what it represents. It represents that the model has reached the power where you can trust. Yeah. It with execution.
And you can do it in Claude, Cowork, equivalent.
You can do it anywhere.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you can use Claude Code, you can use Cowork, you can use API and build your own harness. Like, it doesn't really matter. The model is the power here. The model has reached that potential that you can now trust it with long form execution. It can, like, it's become a habit for me. Every evening, I said, create a whole plan with my Claude Code and leave it jobs for the night. That this is the 5 things you have to do before I wake up. Right? And it does this completely on its own. Like, in the morning, it's there. Maybe there's one bug, maybe there's 2 bugs, maybe sometimes it's completely perfect. The point is, it's almost there. Right? And I think that power that this represents is just amazing.
How should people react?
Yeah. I think we are having same conversations in our company, right? Like, I think we have pushed entire company. We now, like, every reviews, we are rating people on, like, their AI potential,
Nativity.
L1, L2, L3, L4, L5. And I'm telling everyone who's in L1 to L3 that, hey, you guys need to move to L4, L5. Like, they can't be at L1 to L3.
And the beauty is they can self-train.
Yeah, you can
just go and ask.
I think the best thing is with AI, like, for example, in OpenClaw, half of the time, how are the things that I build? I'm asking it, what more can you do for me? Because you know it better than I can.
Yeah.
So what more can you do for me? And it'll tell me 5 best ideas and I'll pick one and then build with it, right? Same with Claude Code now. I ask it, like, hey, I want to do something on this weekend. What do you think I should do?
So there's no excuse not to upskill yourself. Yeah. There's no, everybody going forward, living in the world of AI, the word builder was generally associated with more geeky, techish people. All of us are engineers. Everybody's going to be.
Yeah, I can tell you, like, my GitHub profile, like, I think it is, like, last time it was green was in 2015.
Yeah.
And last 3 months, it has fully been green.
What does that mean? That you are submitting
if you're constantly shipping commits, then it becomes green. Of course, I'm trying to fake it, but I'm just saying real that it has become green in the last 20-30 days since I have been fully on this, because it's just shipping. It's just fun. It's like half of the things I'm building, I have nothing
and
to do with
this. That's what people don't realize. It'll be so much fun.
It's like a
video game. All your tedious routine things that irritate you, just try them with AI.
Yeah.
It'll change your life.
Yeah. And I know you are doing a lot of it. I think he's doing a lot of it.
No, he is on steroids, yes. Like you. And for you, it was a 6-year hiatus. I think for him, it was a 25-year hiatus. He started building.
And I guess it's like a lot of tech founders like me, right? You started with tech. The reason I got into Razorpay is I like doing tech, right? I like building. Over time, of course, you have to, like, scale the company, and, like, the tech part takes a lot of time. So you move away from tech. I think it's the best time for everyone to return back to tech. Like, if you liked coding at any point in your life, you will love it when you pick it up now, because it's just so much faster. I was speaking about SDS, right? Now I look at it like, if this existed, what I spent like 1 year building in SDS, I could have built it in a day. I could have built it in 5 minutes. Yeah. It's just amazing that we spent 4 years, whatever we built in the 4 years of college at SDS, could now be built in a week.
I hope all of you can just hear the animation and the enthusiasm in his voice. But that's sort of how you feel about tech. So we've seen it in a lot of orgs that there is this small hacker community, usually with the founder, that goes all AI native. And they're not able to roll it out to the org.
Yeah.
And now I see pretty much everyone in Razorpay is on the agentic trend line. I saw Killen actually post your stack. I forgot what
Compass,
you called
it.
The Compass stack. So how did this happen so quickly?
How do you do org transformation at scale?
Yeah, and we're still a work in progress. I wouldn't say I'm happy with where we are. Like, there's a lot more to do. I think it starts at the top. And as I'm pushing that, like, we've told every engineering manager that, like, well, because a lot of engineering managers don't get away from coding. Like, every single person has to pick up Claude Code. Every single person has to try something. It doesn't matter what you do. The reason I had to do it, and the reason I want all our managers to do it, is because you need to know the boundaries of the new technology. Right? It's great at a lot of things. It's still not good for a lot of things. If you don't try it, either you'll overestimate or underestimate it. Like, you might expect your engineers to do something in 5 minutes, which they can't do anyway. Still, Or you would expect that, hey, it's going to take months, which can be now done in 10 days or maybe
the
5
power
months.
And the limitations are
So that's the first, like, how do you ensure every single one? So we did last year we did a leadership hackathon where we flipped that. Hackathon is typically done by companies where young engineers participate. We flipped it on and said every leader builds something on RepRed, builds something on AI and show it. And the young builders in the company became judges. So our last hackathon winners became judges, and every leader, including me, presented that, hey, this is what I've built. I came fourth, by the way.
So, flip
your org. It has to start at the top. Flip your org. Unless you start at the top, you won't understand the difference between the power and the limitations. Us going down this rabbit hole has told us where, by the way, we can invest. Half the time when we were investing, we were worried that, is this going to be in the path of the model? ChatGPT will launch something and will this go?
Yeah.
When you go deep, you use the word harness. It's actually our investment thesis. Yeah. Who's building harnesses, right? So in every industry, going back to the question, go deep, do it yourself, and then you'll know a lot of the answers.
Yeah. So I saw this tweet from you, I think, which said, you know, with human agents and virtual agents have the same problem as human agents. Yeah. And is that because we are not thinking about sort of the org structure in a fundamentally different way in this agent universe?
So I think AI makes the execution speed really fast. It makes intelligence available on the fly. But the pro and con of it is, it's going to make your weaknesses appear far more faster, but it's going to make them far bigger as well. So AI doesn't solve your org weaknesses. In fact, so I tried this tool called, it allows you to build AI native companies, which is basically you can give it a task and it goes and builds the entire company. It hires agents, it creates like so you tell it, like, I want to build a, let's say, a B2C marketing platform. It will hire 5 agents, it will create, like, give tasks to them, and they'll start building. And I tried it looked very cool and all of that, and it produced garbage. And I said, why is it producing garbage? I said, because there's no plan. I just told it, build a B2C marketing company. I don't have a plan. I don't have a structure. The agent doesn't know what it's supposed to do and what it's not supposed to do. The boundary is not clear. So the agent just picked that up, gave it to hired five people, told them that this is what you need to do, this is your task, and the agent started doing something. Initially they were doing something right, and then they started drifting in random directions.
Yeah.
They started going in some other direction.
That's the beauty of the... So when people worry about jobs, when people worry about disruption, what they should realize is there is a limitation, and this limitation, by the way, is very architectural.
Yes.
LLMs are not deterministic. By definition, they will drift. So the business opportunity may be even larger, in a much larger TAM, it's just shifted.
Yeah.
But to understand where you have to play in the shift, you have to go deep.
And it's the same as companies. Like, if you start a company and nobody knows the plan, nobody knows what you're supposed to do, and you just say, hey, we are going to build a payment gateway. You are a salesperson, you are an engineering person, you are an ops person, let's just do it.
Yeah.
The companies can't be built like that. Yeah. So this just proved to me in 10 minutes what you learn in a company in a month. That, hey, you can't operate without a plan, you can't operate without a structure.
Yeah.
And I think it was a great learning for me.
You know, I heard Avi say this a few days back, and it really resonated, which was that with any of these AI tools, it can actually show up as either your smartest friend, who, like you said, blew me away, or your dumbest friend. Yeah. Who doesn't?
On the same day.
Sometimes in the same conversation.
So, I worked for 2.5 weeks with our AI developer to redo our entire portfolio review, which we covered yesterday. And these guys are looking at it. It's garbage. So I said, boss, aapne input kya diye
usko? Yes, because it is so good at execution, it produces massive amounts of garbage quickly.
Yeah. And because, which sounds smart.
Because it's so massive, it looks like, oh, wow, what have I done? And I think that's one fundamental delta. While people saying that engineers are better at it, I think one fundamental problem that engineers have in this, and I have many engineers, I have the same problem. A lot of times engineers are excited by the complexity of the build than the outcome of the build.
Yes.
So a lot of times you do something with this, it creates something amazing. You look at, oh, wow, how it's so complex, it's so intricate. You're proud of what you've built because it's so complex. So I tweeted this, like, whenever I build something, I show it to my wife.
Yeah.
And I tell her, like, criticize it. And when she breaks it down, then I realize, oh, I was just excited about the complexity, not by the output.
Yeah.
And you need a fresh take of somebody who just cares about the output, who doesn't care what you've built.
Yeah.
To just tell you that, hey, the output doesn't matter. The output is all garbage.
Yeah.
It sometimes it can be.
So I think in closing on this, the AI opportunity basically shifts where the bottleneck was. It doesn't remove the bottleneck. It upskills where you have to skill yourself. So the bottleneck moves from execution to planning, architecture, checks and balances, what maybe it, one of my colleagues, Akash, calls it harness as a service. Maybe that will become, HaaS will become the new SaaS. So, super. You want to?
No, I do want to pick up one last thread, which is on the Agent Studio. People have called it different things, but I would say it's the most ambitious bet. And I know you believe in the power of AI to finally make SMEs adopt technology.
Yeah.
So, what's that trend line?
Yeah, I think it's. I think India has always jumped trends, and I think the same applies here. India never really adopted the SaaS wave, honestly. And the reason the SaaS wave never took off in India is SaaS accepts a business owner to learn the way a tool works to change their life, and it doesn't work because like you expect a, like a business owner who's been doing sales in a certain way to say, hey, now you have a CRM. Whenever you do a sales, put it in this and type it in this, and then whenever you want to do a new sale, pick it up from there. It's not natural part of their workflow. So US adopted SaaS in a big way. India never really adopted B2B SaaS. And they're counting. There are exceptions to this. For example, maybe accounting had SaaS in some of those, but most of the stuff never really took on the SaaS wave. But AI allows to jump that wave because most SMEs understand hiring. They understand, hey, I want to do sales, I should hire a salesperson. I want to do finance, I should hire a finance person. And I think agents allow you to build it in that way. Right? And that's our stab with Agent Studio, that when you build payments, like most startups, when we work with them, they take payments from us, then they have to hire a team to manage payments. Because as you scale, you have a lot of operations around it. Payment failed, a customer has a complaint, I have to do a refund, I have a chargeback, I have a dispute. Somebody has to manage operations around it. And now we can provide agents because a lot of small guys, because they can't hire all of those, they can't scale beyond a point.
So why limit your agents to payments? Why not run their finance function?
Give us more time.
2 weeks.
Yeah, give us a bit more time. But that's where the world is headed, that when you're starting a company, how can I allow you to hire an agent for everything? So like we have a card abandonment agent, for example. It's nothing to do with payments, honestly. Somebody comes on a website, adds something to cart, goes to the payment screen, and then drops off. And it's at the last payment screen, which means the intent was extremely high. They tried a payment, and then they dropped off. Now there is an agent that picks up the phone, calls this guy, tries to convince them, hey, could you want to come back? Why did you fail? And why did you walk away? He might say, hey, the payment failed. Oh, sure, I'll send you a payment link. I thought it's slightly more expensive. Sure, I'll give you a 200 rupees discount, whatever, and manages it end to end. It works beautifully, right? So thus, just this intelligence on the fly. And I think, so the models are being built by the large LLM companies, but our job is translating the model and the API into a form that a SME can consume. And I think there's a lot of delta in those two things. I think just that, and that's our attempt with Agent Studio, that how do we translate the capabilities of the model to what an SME needs for his day-to-day business? And if we can do that well, I think it can be a massive opportunity.
Before I hand it back to Avnish, you've seen this report that we're doing along with OpenAI. Yeah. And there we have a framework for enterprises adopting AI. And this is sort of the classic journey of a tinkerer to transformer, right? You started off tinkering and saying two hackers, to now the entire org adopting, and now you're actually taking it external to the customers.
Yeah.
Just a fantastic journey to learn from.
And very exciting. A year ago, I think all of us potentially were unclear where we were in the AI race, quote unquote, right? India as a country looking so far behind. And now as the technology has gone to next levels, and I would argue the country is pushing,
yeah.
You know, the India AI Summit, I know you were there, and these things matter. Top down, all these model companies are opening their offices here, therefore the talent will be here. It's exciting. And I think for a change with this SMB thesis, we'll be playing to our strength rather than our weakness,
yeah.
Right? So very excited. Harshal, thank you. Congratulations for everything you guys have done. And it's been a privilege to partner. For people who are watching you, what is your advice? Who are thinking about, who are in their unstarted phase and thinking about starting, or maybe have started and feel they're still unstarted?
I'll separate that. I think for people who are starting up, I think it's fairly clear. I think AI is making it very easy to start new things. And a lot of people are starting it because it's just easy to start. I think my recommendation to people is, like we spoke about the grunt, that if, like, find a problem statement that you can spend the next 5 to 10 years of your life on. Like, it's very easy to start something because it looks cool on AI. But when you think about it, like, is this really what you want to do for the next 5 to 10 years? Can you dedicate when things are going to be hard, when things are not going to work? Can you work through the nights because you so care about the problem statement so much that, hey, I don't care what everyone is saying, I want to do this? I think just think about that, because that's what it's going to take, essentially. Just because if something is easy to start doesn't mean it's going to get easier to sustain. It's still going to take that much effort to build something large and meaningful. If you have started up and you're scaling and you're still figuring out, I think one thing that I have learned, and maybe in some ways learn through failures and successes. That I think I think there's a famous Polygram essay of founder mode.
Yeah.
I think AI is essentially the time when every founder needs to get into founder mode.
Very good.
Because like, I think the core thing is nobody can care about your company more than you do. Right? So
what is founder mode?
So founder mode is like, so there is a micromanager mode, which is you get into everything and you can't scale. And then there is a manager mode where you're saying, I have executives who do the job and I just direct them, which is how large CEOs operate. Founder mode is that you have executives, you have teams who do things, but the things that really matter to the company, the founder has to get into themselves. Like they can't offload the core parts of the company. For Razorpay, that's product and tech. For Razorpay, there's going to be brand. Like what do we stand for? And culture. Like these three things I can't offload. We can hire the best of the best talent in the world, but these three things I have to get into myself. Otherwise, you're setting it up for failure. So for whatever you are building, like there are a couple of things that are going to matter for your business. It could be different for different, but those things as a founder, you can't get away from.
Superb. That's a masterclass. No other closing statement. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thanks, Abhish. Thanks, Vishkam.
Chal, superb. You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.